Hello, I'm Chris Gladwin, the CEO of Osient, and welcome to another edition of our podcast that is all about hyperscale data called Big Bites with Osient. In these conversations, our goal is to explore the industries that are being transformed by the analysis of large data sets, such as ad tech, gov tech, and more. And while I'm interested for sure in the technology of the work being done, I'd also like to focus on the people who are transforming the world with data. Today, I'm excited to announce and welcome Teresa Smetzer. Teresa has served 20 years at the Central Intelligence Agency as a technical analyst and senior manager, participating in and leading multiple transformation-related tasks, task forces, and programs aimed at modernizing the business of intelligence, including the development of the first Directorate of Intelligence strategic plan. Welcome, Teresa. Great to connect, and I'm looking forward to our conversation. Tell us a little bit about your background. I mean, you know, there's the CIA part, but you've also done some other stuff too.
Well, thanks.
Bring us up to speed.
Yeah, it's great to be here today, and I appreciate the opportunity. Yeah, I've had a little bit of an eclectic career. I started pretty much out of college at CIA as a technical analyst, which meant early on I had to figure out creative ways to solve intelligence challenges with highly incomplete data using modeling and simulation and whatever those sort of modern technologies were. Over time, because I was an engineer, I ended up moving more into the sort of innovation side rather than the analyst side. So how do you use technology and data more effectively to address problems that were really difficult through traditional means? And that's really where I've spent the rest of my career. I left government at one point, family issues with my children, and went to industry. So I did a bunch of different things in industry, including starting my own company, which I grew and sold. And then after hanging out for a while, I went back to government to lead an organization called Digital Futures, which was sort of an amalgamation of everything I've done to look at how to get the best of what the industry has to offer or the private sector has to offer and bring that back into the government. So great opportunities for me. So at this point, I've retired like three times. So I'm back to doing fun things like working with companies like Osient.
And so how common is that for people to kind of bounce in and out of the intelligence community?
I think it's there are three or four of us that have done this sort of path. One is John Edwards, who came back to government as the CIO at the same time I came back. Same deal. He'd gone to a company and done good things and really wanted to sort of give back, I guess. Julianne Galena is another one. Mm-hmm. She is now the head of DDI or Directorate of Digital Innovation for CIA. She spent time in government, went out for the startup. The startup got acquired by IBM, so she worked for IBM. And then she came back to government. They're trying to actually codify this more because they see the value of having people have this sort of industry experience or academic experience. But it's hard given the realities of professional life and quality life and so on. So at any rate, I think it's proven to be an effective model and we're trying to figure out how to do more of it in the future.
Yeah, three people is not a big number, you know, compared to how many people are in the U.S. intelligence community.
In fairness, there are more. Those are ones that are more public and have been out there and I think are well known. But it is definitely the exception.
But I could see how it'd be so valuable because one of the big challenges for the intelligence community is how to really be kind of the most efficient, the most up-to-date, taking advantage of technology, which really mainly comes on the commercial side.
Right.
And it's just hard to do. I mean, the whole intelligence community has very important rules about, you know, limiting the flow of information, making things are really, really secure. And it creates some challenges. And if you can get people that, you know, and this isn't just really technology, it comes down to people, and you can get people flowing back and forth, you know, that would really have a big impact. during the times that you've kind of been in and out, how has it changed in terms of what the CIA and other intelligence agencies do, and in particular, like, how has their use of data changed over the decades?
Yeah, great question. When I first came in, we were just getting, in fact, we were the first users of email. We were the first of many advanced technologies. Yeah. We were always at the forefront and, you know, worked with people data and technology-wise that were groundbreakers. I think what really changed the complexity of the world was the fall of the Soviet Union. While it was good for the world, we went from sort of this monolithic problem to now having dozens of problems mm-hmm. around the world that are subnational, that are national, that are regional, that are religion-based, that are highly interconnected with economies. And so today the world is so much more complicated and fast-moving. It's a lot harder to use the sort of more traditional ways of engaging in intelligence. And so data is at the heart of that in many ways. How do you develop the means to sense things are changing and know what those changes might mean and try to proactively take action to help the government writ large think about policies to mitigate a possible risk that could go from a societal issue to a regional conflict to full-on war early on to sort of manage that. So today the world is so much more complicated and interdependent, which really has put data at a premium.
And I would think the volume of data that the intelligence community deals with is orders and orders of magnitude beyond what it was. It's not just like, oh, I had lunch with someone yesterday and here's the seven things they told me. It's like, no. We looked at, there's a billion social media conversations that can go on. You know, I mean, it's just the numbers have to be just mind-bogglingly larger, right?
Yeah, so you're right. It's not just the volume. We also talk about the velocity and the variety. So the variety of data, video, audio, structured text, unstructured text, you know, data that's been picked up in some random place in some random way, and then the velocity, right, which is just faster and faster. And so it's the volume, the variety, and the velocity of the data that really is kind of complicates our mission.
Those three V's. And we see it, you know, I see it, I think a lot of people see it in the Ukraine war, in that every day, the resolution of information that's available about what happened down to like the individual tank, you know, where it went and what it shot at. And, you know, like this tree line is currently a battle, like as of an hour ago, like the data is fresh. It's video. It's all this information about what type of equipment, how many people that is so different than, you know, if you look at, you know, prior wars, you just had like little snippets, you know, like 6 minutes of news, you know, on the evening news. That's what you got. That was the whole day's data.
Right.
It seems like it's just completely transformed.
It is. The good news is, I'd say within the next 5 years or so, the public sector writ large, not just intelligence, has recognized the importance of data as a strategic asset for informing decision making and also for driving innovation. And so you know, you're really seeing the entire federal government in different ways recognize that data, it's all about the data. And the Director of National Intelligence, which oversees the intelligence community organizations, they have a very strategic, in my opinion, kind of data strategy, which is to perform end-to-end data management, deliver data interoperability and analytics at speed and scale, advance all partnerships to continue digital and data innovation, transform the IC workforce to be data-driven. I mean, that's bold, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so the good news is there's a broad recognition now of the need to be data-driven, data-informed, treat data as an asset. And but the reality is there's still a lot of challenges. It's not just the volume, velocity, and variety. It's that these organizations have all this legacy data that they've got to deal with that wasn't even really a strategic asset when it was collected. So how do they deal with that data, right?
Yeah.
It's a big, just a quick story, which I think illustrates that. I have a colleague who's a very, very skilled, advanced data engineer, and he was working for one of the big software companies, helping the Navy and one of their aircraft. They were having significant issues. And so he was so passionate about this data approach. He joined the Navy as a civilian employee for 3 years. And first thing he realized is they were collecting data on these aircraft operations monthly, and then they delete it, and then monthly, and then they delete it. He said, no. We have to keep this data in perpetuity.
Right.
And within months, probably 6 months to 8 months, he was able to build models that help them with predictive analytics,
right,
operations and maintenance, performance-related issues. And so it was stunning how much of a difference it made with somebody who understood how to use data in a way that would inform decision-making, but also allow them to be more predictive. So now DOD, big DOD, is saying, well, maybe we should do this for everything. Well, you talk about volume, right? So
millions of vehicles.
Yeah. I think that's the kind of recognition of going from this plane where they initially thought, well, we'll just keep a month of data and then throw it away and then a month of data, and that'll be sufficient, right? Without thinking about the power of what we can do today.
Yeah. One of the things that's been exciting for me is I've had the opportunity in my career to kind of touch the intelligence community at various times.
Right.
Is seeing a little bit about how it really works. And, you know, it's a giant, you know, army of really dedicated, intelligent, capable people. And I guess that's one of the things I think it's, you know, I'd like to get your perspective on. Like that was one of my impressions. You know, it seems like the CIA and other agencies aren't always portrayed in the most positive light in the media, you know, because it's a better story sometimes. But I don't know, what was your impression of the overall community, the people there, in terms of their capabilities and their integrity?
Yeah, well, that's a topic I'm very passionate about. I think that it's not just the news, it's also the movie industry. It's
right.
Two of my colleagues and I did a South by Southwest talk on that very topic 3 years ago, I think it was, called Sisterhood of Spies, and about how the film industry and television shows distort the perception of how the intelligence community works, and the quality and the diversity of perspective, diversity in every sense of our workforce. So I agree with you. I think it is, unfortunately, our community is often misrepresented and blame for things that we had nothing to do with just because it seems like the sexy thing to do.
Right.
When in fact, we've got a lot of people that are really smart working on these problems.
Yeah. When it comes to data, one of my other experiences is, you know, we have the opportunity at Ocean, since we make these giant, you know, compute intensive always on systems, to work with the largest data analyzing organizations in the world. That's basically what we do.
Right.
And I can tell you, you know, the intelligence community in particular in the U.S. is the most thorough about kind of data usage and data ethics and only doing stuff that is legal. I mean, in their mind, there's no gray area unless it is absolutely sure that they can do it. They don't do it.
Right.
And that just seems completely out of whack with a lot of public perception, a lot of public kind of content, is that, oh, these people are fast and loose. Like,
yeah,
no, they're not.
Oh,
they're so locked down.
You're so right. And that is one of the challenges we face, is that we go to such measures.
Yeah.
Sure, that we comply with the laws and the regulations and the policies and the privacy and ethics related issues that, sometimes it's a challenge when
it limits capabilities.
Yeah, totally. And so I think That is a huge misperception that there's so much that we do that's somehow illegal or unethical, or it's not the case at all. That right. drives everything we do. And that's why some of the data strategies are a challenge, because we have to, by design, we have to comply with those.
It would be much easier if it's just like, here's the data, do whatever. That's not how it is.
Right. Of course, for our adversaries, that's where they have, in some ways, sort of an unfair advantage, because they don't care about privacy. They don't care about human rights. They don't care about the laws or the norms. So they just do whatever they feel like. Yeah. And so, you know, that's where it gets difficult.
Yeah. Are there any other, like in the technology realm, in the intelligence community, are there other things that you feel just the public perception is a little bit off? You know, that it doesn't really work that way, especially when it comes to technology.
Well, I think the hot topic right now, obviously, for everybody is AI. And so, you know, AI is definitely a huge opportunity for the national security community to deal with all this data that we're talking about. There's no way it's the man-machine sort of, or human-machine sort of combination that's going to have to help address those problems. Humans simply can't go through that quantity of data.
Right.
But as you well know, the AI is sort of like saying air at this point. I mean, everybody uses AI all day long today. They just don't really think of it as AI, whether it's Waze or whether it's recommender engines that tell you, the stuff that they're really talking about is more of moving towards more general intelligence. And that's where I think, people worry that somehow the intelligence community or national security more generally could get out ahead of what is ethical and reasonable. And I just don't see that at all. It's really much more about experimenting with things that are within the bounds of what are ethical norms, and there's so much published on that. And then how do we use data platforms and data capabilities that empower that sort of use of artificial intelligence? So I read somewhere there's now 6,000 or 7,000 AI companies in the United States.
Wow.
So how do you deal with the enormity of, you know, everything from a really big enterprise, publicly traded in capabilities through some, you know, couple of graduate students at a university that have a concept, right? So I think that AI is probably, in addition to the data challenges, one of the biggest sort of areas of, and part of it is everybody has a different level of understanding of what AI is. And, you know, when you read stuff, people say, well, let's just stop. We have to stop until we figure out how we're going to control this. Well, how do you stop AI? It's already ubiquitous.
So, stopping is not a way of controlling when it comes to this kind of stuff. It really means you're giving up control because it's going to proceed. And, you know, we've seen this every time the digital technology of the day consumes a new type of content. You know, we saw this with, software, with music, with film. Now we're seeing it with kind of applied human intelligence. And you really ultimately have to have some legislation for some rules of the road, but the legislation takes forever. And meanwhile, technology marches ahead. So, you know, it seems like we're in this phase where the technology is well ahead of the policy.
Right.
You know, eventually, you know, we have to catch up if we want to be competitive, both in terms of commercially, you know, as technology companies, and with intelligence.
Right, right. The other challenge that I would highlight is, if you think about 5 or 6 years ago, and what any big government agency would think of as a data management platform, I'm sure it was a very sensible decision at that point.
Mm-hmm.
But things have changed already so dramatically in terms of just if you're talking about a petabyte plus of data, that's a very different capability than even, you know, 5 years ago.
Right.
Or if you're talking about the diversity and the variety of the data that we have. And so then it's this challenge of, well, do we throw out what we thought was the solution? How do we innovate around this? It's, you know, so that's another area that I think the government struggles is sort of some emergent thing comes out that clearly is a game changer. So now what do they do? And so I see that in AI and data more generally, I see that as a constant challenge for the government.
Yeah. Well, one of the challenges we're seeing in AI, in computing in general, is increased power consumption and just the footprint demands of these systems that are accelerating. Data centers as a category passed California a few years ago as a consumer of energy and will soon pass Brazil, which is a large economy, as a consumer of energy. And the rate of growth, according to the IEA, for data center energy use is doubling between every 2 and 4 years. They have different models, like different climate models, to project the growth of energy for data center power consumption. And if something is doubling every 2 to 4 years, it's not a question of if it uses a million times more, it's just a question of how soon. And there's just no way you can have a million times more energy. You know, something's already about the size of Brazil and what it consumes. You know, you can't have a million Brazils of energy. And you can't have a million Brazils of rack space and physical data center locations. So I guess, you know, from your experience, how much has this power acceleration and space and just footprint, how much is energy starting to limit what can be done with data analytics in the intelligence community?
So great question. There are, like all federal bureaucracies, there are people that worry about facilities, and they're really the ones front lines of having to think through, you know, power, water, the footprint, whatever other parameters there are around the operations. I can tell you when the cloud centers and all the federal government has gone to a cloud first certainality, when they were first selected, power wasn't really in the mix, right?
Right.
So now flash forward, it's like, oh my gosh, now we recognize the power issues. It's kind of like my sunk cost argument about data management platforms. Do you go back in and redo the data centers? I mean, that's, you know, that's not really practical. I definitely think there is now a focus on this and a sort of a recognition of what do we do. Yeah. I heard from a colleague at Northern Virginia, as you almost certainly know, is because of the federal government sucks power out and data out of these data centers, Northern Virginia has become a hub of data centers. That's kind of big. Particularly Loudoun County, which is one county over from where most of the federal agencies are. I've heard for the first time that Loudoun County is now rejecting any permits to build new data centers. And this is more from a colleague who lives there, not from my governmental experience, but on the basis of power, that they can't support the power that's required today and also support residents. And so I the good news is I think people are now focused on the problem. I don't know what the solution is or how that's going to play out over time, other than awareness, and really starting to think about low power options that are going to help offset some of the demand.
Well, one thing that certainly is going to need to happen is power consumption has to become a part of the purchase decision. Because if you look at RFPs flying around today, they don't have like, you know, they'll tell you in detail like cost, like it can only cost this much for this and this and this, and capacity. Oh, it's got to do this and this and 100 pages on, you know, what are the features it has to have. There's no page on, and here's the max power use and our ability to shift power consumption to off hours times. And like, because power consumption isn't just a number like performance, it's a complex set of requirements, and they're not even in there. So it's not driving purchase decisions. And when it does, which it has to, you're going to see, you know, a lot of focus. But, you know, and a lot of that focus is required because the whole the whole apparatus of intelligence seems like it's becoming more digital, dependent upon energy. So I guess, could you characterize, like, from your experience when you kind of entered the CIA to, you know, what you think the total, like, how much of that used to be digital in terms of intelligence was a digital process versus now? Like, what percent of intelligence, what percent of security is cybersecurity? What percent of intelligence is digital intelligence?
Well, when I started, I'm really going to age myself here because it's been a long time.
You're in good company.
We've
been doing this a while.
We got reading boards. So we're clipboards that somebody put together early in the morning with all the printouts or hard copy of.
Right.
But I mean, that's where I started, right? So there was no digital anything initially.
Like my office at work, probably yours too, had a stapler, scissors, like a ruler. I remember having a ruler. You know, all these things to work with paper.
Right.
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 So I don't have those things anymore.
No, with somebody's computer down, it literally is like, oh my God, the world's going to end. We've got to do something. You know, everything.
We can't work.
We're
completely dependent on this tool.
Totally. So I think it's hard to even some of the questions you ask. I mean, cybersecurity is a critical part of any national security related issue. It's, but there are many other aspects that are of intelligence that are demand power too, not the least of which is, you know, pushing content that's tailored to an individual's responsibilities to them digitally every day, and then having to go through those documents digitally, and then apply tools that allow you to do, whether it's link analysis or, you know, I mean, there's a whole suite of tools, all digital, right? So it really is hard to even, I think it'd be hard to even calculate what the energy demand would be in with all of those capabilities. But I agree with you, until we start putting cost, power as a factor in cost and
right
and selection of capabilities, it's kind of something over here that somebody worries about, but I have to do my job. I can't deal with the fact that this thing I'm using takes a lot of power.
Yeah, but it seems like that your characterization is decades ago, the non-digital aspects of intelligence were dominant, but
right.
More and more digital intelligence, the 100%. Way you gather information, the way you analyze information, it's the digital methods are becoming dominant.
Totally. In fact, it's hard for me to think of ways that aren't digital that work gets done today. It's so broad.
So is that another example where a lot of those spy movies get it wrong? You know, they're just thinking, oh, this is all about people and intrigue and affairs and relationships.
Sure.
And
oh, my gosh. Yeah, I could pick on a couple of them that are just, it makes me cringe. You know, you watch them for entertainment, but I have to keep reminding myself this is not, you know, this is not the way things really work. An individual who saves the day kind of thing,
that's
not the way it works. It's a team of people that are multidisciplinary, that have lots of different types of background and experience, that are behind the scenes making things happen. And that really is the way things are. It's not an individual.
So in some ways, it looks like a tech company. Like if you were to walk around the hallway and look at people and just kind of hear them talking and what they're doing, it's like you could be walking around a software company. It wouldn't be that different?
Yeah, that's a very good point. And if you recall back to the data strategy that I mentioned earlier in our conversation, transform the IC workforce to be data-driven.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that inherently means you have to be able to operate in the digital world with a lot of data and have some faculty with how do you use this stuff to achieve your whatever your mission is. And it, you know, whether you're a political scientist or whether you're an economist or whether you're international relations or whether you're an engineer, it's kind of, you have to be data savvy, right? Which means be digital savvy.
So does that mean then a lot of the the work, some of the work that the, particularly the senior leaders in the intelligence community have to do is they have to go back to political leadership, because political leadership does still make decisions about things like budget and even the electorate, and kind of educate on these issues of like, this is the world we're in now. It's not, you know, we're a bunch of lawless, ethics ignoring people. We're like, you know, very capable and, technologists and, you know, managers. Yeah. And this is the future world. If we want to have security, we want to have intelligence, we're going to have to be great at this. And educating, you know, both political leaders and just kind of the people in general, like, this is the new world. It's not like a spy movie. You know, it's like a tech company. And yeah. If we're, you know, we have a mission, you know, security, intelligence is like, that's a mission. That's important, you know, but to be great at that, we're going to have to be great at these things.
Right.
The technology part of this.
Right. Well, and I think you saw a little bit of that in after Russia invaded Ukraine, and the leadership of the intelligence community all the way up the chain.
Right.
We had to make a decision to release information that
yes.
showed exactly how bad it was.
Yes.
What was happening. And that's very painful for my community, right? Because they're worried about all kinds of things.
Yeah, because like culturally, the idea that you're going to put into the public
right.
all this information we've gathered.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Is not. So I think there's a growing recognition that the public is as much a customer as the more traditional policymakers.
Yeah.
And CISA, the cybersecurity, CISA, I have to think about what that acronym stands for. The cybersecurity folks that really are responsible for overseeing cybersecurity for the federal government, they sit within NSA. They have a whole protocol for pushing stuff out to tech companies in particular
yeah.
about bugs or things that that they've caught people trying to do that compromise networks, and trying to inform the public, companies as well as individuals, just what is happening. There was just a hearing 2 weeks ago with Senator Warner and Senator Rubio, who co-chair the Intelligence Committee, on disinformation, which is, I mean, we talked about that, right? Like, so
right.
how much information is out there that is being pushed for whatever reason, whether it's a foreign adversary or whether it's a criminal element or whether it's people that just have a point of view that, you know, and so how do you help the public discern what's true and what's not? And so that's, so I think the long answer to getting to what your point is, or the short answer is, we're going to have to view the public as more of a customer and trying to help inform and expose some of these ideas so that the public understands we're not operating rogue. We're trying to help protect people from bad things.
And it seems like disinformation is also becoming an increasing part of the intelligence. Yeah. You know, and, you know, that example you cited about how the U.S. Shared substantial information
yeah.
on how Russia was preparing to invade Ukraine.
Right.
And that, you know, having had the opportunity to spend some time with some of the folks who were part of that decision, of course, I had like a billion questions like, oh, you know, how'd that work? And it seemed like it really paid off, you know, like because it wasn't just getting the right information out. It was defeating the disinformation campaign that was accompanying the invasion. And, you know, once all that information was out, like, here's what's happening, like Russia's attempt to characterize it very differently couldn't succeed. You know,
right.
and it was easier for the NATO countries to hang together. It was easy for the U.S. to follow up with the kind of support that we followed up with, because it seemed to have thwarted the disinformation campaign that would have otherwise happened.
Well, that was the intent, as I understand it. And I agree with you. I think it was very effective. It's sort of
yeah.
diffusing,
yeah.
letting this sort of disinformation that we knew would come kind of get the front track, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it was a very bold move, and it proved to be effective and getting people to see just what exactly they're dealing with or we're dealing with as a country. And I think more of that is probably going to help over time at sort of saying, hey, we can't operate the way we used to. Do you want us to help protect society, or, you know, are you okay with having the lawlessness of nobody to protect? You know, so it's, intelligence is the first line of defense. That's what we're taught from day one. And so that's kind of the calculation, public.
Right. And then that this intelligence is becoming more about not only managing information, but disinformation. That's intelligence.
Right.
And that seems to be a big part of the future. So yeah. I think that's a great note to wrap up. Do you want to make one final point before we close this up?
I was going to just elaborate a minute. The information, or the idea of disinformation, really gets down to the provenance of data. And how do we think about the provenance? Where did it come from? And how can we validate that it's actually what it appears to be? And so that's a big area of impact right now, is just really getting at that provenance issue, because it is really hard.
For technologists like us, it sounds even more sophisticated and complicated than it was before.
Yeah, for sure. So now this is great. And I think it's great to have companies like OCN out there. And the challenge is, you're so disruptive and different. How do you get people to see why that's exactly they need to look at OCN as part of their solution?
Awesome. Well, thanks, Teresa, so much. This is a great conversation. I could keep going for days on this kind of stuff. So I really appreciate you taking the time to give us, you know, some really amazing insights into kind of what's going on in the world of intelligence and how it's changing, particularly with data and growing data and disinformation and all this fascinating technology. For those of you listening at home, you'll find more out about OCN if you go to OCN.com. And you can find the Big Bites with OCN podcast by searching across any major podcast platform. Thanks again, Teresa. And thanks so much, everybody, for joining us. That was a blast.